we hear a lot of guys, you know, have the midlife crisis. You know, they've been living their whole life up until this point, and they're like, well, I just want to do over. I'm hitting the reset button. I'm buying a Corvette and, you know, forget it. So talk about identity. How does Joe feel confident that Joe knows who Joe is and what he was put on planet Earth to do? Do you feel like it's always a process of discovery? Do you ever have it down, or is it kind of like trying to nail Jell-O to a tree?
So when I was young, it was hard because I knew who I was, and my environments did not support who I was. Mm-hmm. And so it was really tough to, like, because you feel like conforming most of the time when you're a little bit odd, a little bit different than everybody else. You feel like it's easier to assimilate than it is to stand out, right? So I spent like years just trying to fit in, and I was like, screw this. And I spent the latter half, the back nine, trying to stand out. So I think, you know, you do go through an evolution, and when you get comfortable with who you are, and I don't know that there's some people who will ever be comfortable with truly, and they fake it their entire life, and that's kind of a sad thing.
It is. Because when you're comfortable in your own skin, people are attracted to that. The authenticity of, hey, this is who I am. If you don't like it, you don't like it. If you like it, great.
Right.
But I'm not here because you like it or don't like it. I'm here on purpose for a reason. And I'm going to continue to do that regardless of maybe the opinions around me, the opinions of a boss or parents. You know, early on for a lot of people, parents determine a lot of that trajectory. Parents get to speak things over their kids. Parents get to set kids up with opportunities or keep kids from opportunities. Parents do a lot to set that course, especially early on. What are some of the things that you felt like in childhood were kind of helped chart your course? And sometimes they do things and they're not necessarily on purpose, but they have the result. Sometimes they withhold stuff from you, you know, out of discipline or whatever, but it just ends up putting a chip on your shoulder and you end up pressing harder into that. So sometimes parents unknowingly they're shaping your identity one way or the other. Was there anything growing up that you look at and you go, man, that really shaped who I became?
Well, you're going to just be surprised you, but I was a rebel. Right? Yeah. And so, like, literally, if you said black, it was white. I mean, across the board. So a lot of what I found my way into was just because I created that controversy within just to be that rebel. I always had to do it, and I had to push on the status quo and lean on it to discover it. And so a lot of it is that, you know, I was just trying to be the devil's advocate, and I lucked into a lot of those, you know, those things. So
was that built in, or was that nurtured?
That's a good question. I want to say it would be built in, and then my kid is completely different than that, mm-hmm. where I got to prod him to push against the grain a little bit.
Sure. You know, it's interesting. I think there are some of those things. I'm a firm believer that about 90% of who we are is put inside of us at birth. And most of life circumstances either reveal or conceal those things about us. And so we're fighting our whole life to reveal truly who we are on the inside. And a lot of people have learned to either build really good walls so they can conceal everything. And then some folks never develop what is revealed. So it's fine that something gets revealed, but then you have to put the work in to harness it and use it like a good tool. It doesn't do any good for me to be like, well, you know, I got this power saw, you know, I've never had anybody show me how to use it, and I just cut my hand off with it. Like, some of the things that get revealed in our lives are super powerful. You know, I know as a kid, my dad did a couple of things for me. My mom did a couple of things for me, and I look back and they were very intentional with certain things. And even the things that they were intentional with that were probably not good things, they shaped me, and those things have panned out for, I think, you know, good in my own life. But, you know, my dad, for instance, I can remember coming home with all of my textbooks from school, and the first night before you wrap them in the brown paper bag to keep them safe, or the book socks or whatever, he would be like, just leave them there. And I would go up to bed, I don't know, 8:30, whatever. And by the next morning, you know, all the books would be sitting there, and he'd take a Saturday morning and he'd leaf through all of them just to see what I was going to be engaging and learning and what they were putting in and emphasizing and what they were leaving out. His main focus was history and science. He didn't care too much about math, maybe some in English, but he would look at those books and he'd be very intentional about it. And then he would have this style of conversation with me. Hey, you know, I want you to understand that everything in these books has a point of view, has a slant to it. I have a slant on life too. And we would have these dialogues, and he'd say, throughout the school year, when you get to certain sections, I want to sit and I want to talk to you about it, because they're teaching it from this perspective, but there's this whole portion they're not telling you about, and we're going to have a conversation. And didn't always happen, but I would say 50% of the time, you know, something would come up in history class. He'd be like, all right, let's sit down and let's hear both sides. And he would do a good job of, he would push his opinion, but I had a personality that I would push back. And so it helped me sharpen and develop my own thing. And he always said to me, I want you to be able to stand on your own 2 feet. Like, just because I have this opinion doesn't mean you need to have this opinion. Now, he might push me to have that opinion, or if I said I had a different opinion, he's gonna make sure that I have that opinion and I'm not just blowing smoke. And so those, I look at that sort of stuff as being super shaping. My mom with you know, memory verses, and you know, she was the one that put us to bed at night, and we said our prayers, and she taught us how to do that stuff. And I wouldn't be who I am today without some of that stuff. So parents play a huge role in this. The other thing that I know, for at least for me, is my parents were like, look, as long as whatever you're doing it all for the glory of God, we're behind you. So you want to go make, you know, tiddlywinks for the Lord, like, go do it. You want to travel, you want to be a chef, you want to be a custodian, you want to own a hotel, you want to start a business, like, whatever you want to do, just as long as you're doing it with integrity and you're doing it, like we are behind you. And so I never felt forced. Like, some parents are like, my kid is going to be, and they force them into a mold. They always gave me space, and they always cheered on the stuff that that I was doing. And I so appreciate that, because there were times where my dad played college tennis, and he wanted one of his three boys to play tennis. None of us played tennis. Every year, every summer, 1 week, dad required us to go to tennis camp, and he would sit in his folding chair, take time off from work, and he'd watch us play tennis. None of us played tennis, but that was it. He was like, you're going to do it? That's the end of it. It's my 1 week of whatever. And I mean, we were athletic, so we had fun with it, but we all played, you know, baseball, basketball, soccer, wrestling, that sort of stuff, football. And we did, you know, we weren't into that for whatever reason. And, you know, but my dad got that 1 week, but then he was at every game. He was at every, he never played baseball, but man, he'd sit down that right field line and cheer us on. And, you know, he learned how to keep the book so that he could, you know, engage in conversation. And all of that stuff, shaped my brothers and I, and shaped our identity in a positive way. Now, there were some things that my parents did that weren't always good. Some of the ways my dad chose to discipline was negative reinforcement, and was certain things that, you know, the verbal tongue lashings and stuff like that. There are times where, you know, you need correction, and but there's a way to do that correction so that it brings about the results that you want. And so it left me with a chip on my shoulder in certain things, and probably forced me in a different direction that I wouldn't have gone. And maybe I wouldn't have been as tough. Maybe I wouldn't have had as much perseverance if I hadn't heard some of that stuff. So from Joe's childhood, what are some of those things, you know, were your parents tough on your grades? Were they, did they give you a lot of freedom? I know you said you were a rebel. So did they have a ton of rules that you pushed against?
Everything. Like, it wasn't matter what it was. And it was a push against.
Even if it was a good thing and you were like, oh, I could see the benefit of that.
I was following the logic. So I would poke holes in it to see, you know, like, what's the reason for this? And then that was not a thing to say, because then we went, as soon as you want to know the logic, there was no longer a logical conversation. It was because I told you to, and then we got into fascism, and I pushed against that. And yeah, it wasn't great.
That's awesome. So as your identity took shape and you decided to be an entrepreneur and you've done that, I know a lot of people, when people ask, well, who are you? The first thing they talk about is what they do. And what they do is an outflow of who they are. It may be an expression of who they are, but it is not all encompassing as to who they are. And so it's kind of a shallow way to say, oh, I'm a pastor. Well, pastor's part of what I do, but it's not really who I am.
Right.
An entrepreneur is something that you do. You're the owner of Youngstown Soup, but that doesn't encompass Joe. Right. Even to say, you know, I'm the husband to Sam, that is an expression of who I am. It's a big part of who I am, but that doesn't encompass all that I am. Or dad to my kids. You know, some people really focus on one role over the other. And I think it tends to be where you get the most value, the most pushback in a good way. You know, when guys get a lot of positive affirmation at work, they tend to dump a lot of time into work. When home gets really tough, like, well, at least at the office, I'm getting a raise. When the kids are doing really well, it's easy to be there. When the kids are tough, it's like, well, I guess I'll stay, you know, I guess I'll go out with the boys tonight or whatever. We tend to go where we're celebrated, and we tend to go with what's easiest. And so that becomes our identity. I see this a lot of times with married couples. They have a couple kids, and the kids become their identity. Everything they do is for the kids. The kids rule the roost. The kids get this. The kids, all that stuff. And then all of a sudden, the kids do this magical thing, Joe. They turn 18. They grow up. They go off to college. They move in with somebody. They get married. And all of a sudden, mom and dad are there, and they're like, who are you?
What?
Because our whole life was our whole identity was revolved around two or three kids, and we poured all this time in, and now they're gone, and we don't have anything in common.
Yep.
And so identity is so important, because when we can define that, it steers everything else in our life. So if someone came to you and was like, Joe, I'm talented, I'm young, I just got my degree, no idea what I want to do, have no idea who I am, what should they do?
Man. So if you did it to me, and I'm an oddball, so maybe you'll be able to use this or not. You know, when the guidance counselors try to figure out what you should do for a living, like
take the tests and stuff like that.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, and that's sort of like where you're going to be comfortable, like where you're going to fit in, where you're going to have a little bit of happiness. You're going to have less friction to do it. And if you did those things, you'd probably be miserable, you know, in overall. So if somebody like, okay, well, I got to figure out the stuff that I want to dedicate the rest of my life doing, it's not going to take a carrot for me to figure what that is out. If I can figure out what I would do, regardless if I'm being paid for it or not, right, I'm probably on the right track, right? So if I'll go into my back room and put a bunch of, you know, put a radio station together using like MacGyver type of electronics, right, that's probably where I'm going to end up, right?
Yeah. Well, I certainly think those expressions change over time, because you didn't always do Youngstown Studio.
Right.
You used to do a computer company. Well, you still do a computer company, but you've expanded and you've seen different avenues, and you've watched different things come your way. You know, when I look at you know, my life and the trajectory that I've been on, you know, what I do is not always a reflection of who I am and where I'm going. And so when I get those folks in that spot, I usually ask two questions. I'll ask them to do an activity, and one, it could be a little cheesy, but if you were going to write your autobiography at the end of your life, what would be the title and what would be on the cover? Or if you're not artsy and you don't like to draw and stuff like that, if you had to give your eulogy, what would you want said? And when people sit down to write their eulogy or think about an autobiography at the end of their life, you kind of cut out all the crap, all the excess. You think about the stuff you worried about in high school. Like when I'm in the box, no one's showing up to my funeral being like, you know, his senior year, he was 7-1 as a pitcher. He was really, really good. Nobody's going to say that.
Nope.
Nobody's going to say, oh, you know, at his first job, he made $32,000 a year. Like, nobody's going to care. And it's the things that we emphasize right now in life. You know, they're not gonna, I use the adage when I preach, you know, you never see a hearse pulling a U-Haul. You just don't. And so the legacy and the stuff you leave behind is the stuff people are gonna remember, not the, you can't take it with you. And so you need to make those investments in people and things that are gonna outlive you. So it puts me in a spot where, you know, when somebody does that and they sit down and they write their eulogy or they write their, draw that cover of their autobiography, it kind of puts all the extra crap that you've been worried about that really doesn't count to the side. So what would be the title of Joe's autobiography?
I've tried to do this a couple of times, and I struggle looking through like the legacy, through that spectrum, because I don't really. So I live my life pretty much that if somebody opened the door right now, there would be no surprises, right? It's authentic, it's raw. Right. You know, if you're talking to me here, and so if you know the curtains closed right now, it would just be the end that I picked for that day. You know what I mean? So when I look forward, like, well, what would I be doing on that day? Is how the eulogy would be, because it changes. You know?
Yeah, yeah. I think the title to your autobiography, though, just in talking with you, would be "Rebel with a cause instead of Rebel Without a Cause.
Oh, I like that. Yeah, so that's pretty good.
A little, you know, play. I had thought about this before the show came in. I didn't think of that on the spot.
I was giving you credit as of this on the fly.
On the fly there, but I know you identify yourself in that way as, you know, hey, I was kind of a rebel growing up. I love to go against the grain. And I think that's true in whatever you do. You're looking to disrupt the status quo, whether that's starting a business, whether that's, you know, giving to some sort of charity you believe in. You just, hey, I see a problem here and I want to fix it. And so I'm going to disrupt that. You know, all the water's flowing this way and everybody says it has to flow that way. Well, I'm building a dam.
Right.
And that's kind of your personality. I mean, that's a snapshot.
Well, there's something in the chemistry of my personality that irritates me when I have, when somebody uses like an absolute on something that maybe I'm a little unsure of, right? And so when someone makes a declaration about how something is, I'm thinking, I'm putting that through my truth machine. Yeah, and I'm like, wait a minute, that might be true, but you don't know that it's true. And that's where my causes begin, is when I'm like, you know what, let's poke a couple holes in that and see how you feel about that.
Yeah.
It's not really about the fight. It's about, like, if we end up hashing it out and there's something left over, I feel better about what's left over.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, so for me, that's the first kind of spot I go to, because it's a little disarming. It's fun. It's, you know, to draw and kind of label your autobiography, or to sit down and write your eulogy and think, what would people actually say? You know, if I'm laying in the casket, what does that look like? And that can be a little more sobering than the autobiography. But both of those give you a nice snapshot of what you want. Who do you want at the funeral? You know, are you old? Are you young? Are you, I mean, it's a bunch of those kind of questions. Then the second thing is probably more practical. There's plenty of tests you can take. You can take the Enneagram. You can take the DISC assessment. You can take all that stuff. And that's going to give you an idea, personality-wise, of what you might be good at, what would be maybe a healthy career for you to go in, or at least one that would use your personality as an asset rather than a deficit. Have you ever taken any of those personality tests?
I have, yeah. And they're predictable as all get out. Your, just A, and A.
Did you do the Enneagram?
No, didn't do that one.
Oh, we got to have you do the Enneagram.
Okay.
So I'm the 3-est-3 that's ever 3'd, according to my sister.
Okay.
She's very, so it's a scale 1-9, and you have wing numbers and stuff. It's pretty cool. And then have you done the DISC assessment?
I think that one. That's the Ramsey one.
D-I-S-C. Yeah.
Right.
And Do you remember?
I don't remember now, but it was predictable, whatever it was. Yeah. I was like, yeah, I could have guessed that one to be going into it.
You're probably, I bet you're probably like a DC, maybe. You're not an S in any way. I'm an ID, so I'm very interpersonal. I like people. And then the D is the person that wants to get crap done. And so I want to do something, I want it to be fun, and I want to do it with people I enjoy it with, but I want to do something significant. I just want to, you know, play tiddlywinks for the sake of, you know, playing cards or whatever. I want to be on our way somewhere. But those things can be very revealing, but they're not necessarily defining. And some people take those and they're like, well, I can only ever do this because I took 3 personality tests and it says this. And those are, you know, like taking the temperature in the room, but you can turn up the heat and change the temperature in the room. So just because you might be wired that way doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, you can only do this or you can only be that in your life. So all those are great. But usually where I go with people is I ask them a series of questions. And it goes along the line, I think, of the one you said earlier. But if you could do anything you wanted to and you knew it would succeed, what would you do?
Jeez, I don't know.
Yeah. It's one of those questions that you dig into a little bit. Because if you can answer that question, it's, you know, I had a mentor ask me that early on. If you could do anything and you knew it would succeed, what would you do? I think it was like 19 or 20. And I was,
you know what? That sort of doesn't work for me because I love the experimentation. If there's no failure and there's no learning that happens, I almost don't want to do it. Have somebody who wants to need some successes go do that one.
Well, 90% of the population is terrified to fail.
Okay.
And so when you label the question that way, it frees them up to be like, well, if I knew I could succeed at anything, I'd be a news anchor, or I would. I was talking to one of the guys at the rehab yesterday. I was asking these questions and we were talking about identity a little bit. And he was like, well, this guy's like 25 years old. And he's like, man, I'd love to work at a zoo and work with animals. You know, it's just so pure and they're so nice and going on and on about these animals. And I was like, he's like, yeah, but that ship sailed. And I was like, what are you, like 95? Like, I was like, are we going to be, you know, like, no, like go, you continue working the program, get yourself sober and
Go do that.
Like, yeah. I don't understand why that ship sailed. But for most people, they're like, well, you know, I probably wouldn't be any good at it. I couldn't do the educate. They come up with the 97 reasons why they can't. And so that's why I label and phrase that question that way. Like, if you knew you were going to 100% succeed, what would you do? And most people immediately, it's like, well, I would do that one thing, but I know I'd fail at it, so I'm not going to do it.
Right.
And then you start breaking down, like, all right, if that's the thing you're going to do, this is how my mentor followed up that question. He says, you're a coward if you don't do it. And I was like, huh. Yeah. And, right. And but it's one of those things, like, you know, if you've been put, you only get one life, you've been put on this earth, and that's the one thing comes out of you in 3.5 seconds because you know you're going to succeed at it, then you're a complete wuss if you don't go do it. And it puts it in perspective because, you know, at the end of the day, I want to do what I've been built to do on the earth. And I want to, whether that's, you know, leading a church, sitting here talking with you on a podcast, whether that's guest speaking somewhere, whether that's traveling, whether that's coaching somebody, whether that, whatever I'm called to do, that's what I want to be doing. And so that first question then leads to a series of other questions, because maybe the thing that you want to do is nice, but there's no path to making money with it. There's no path to sustainability. Well, then you have a hobby.
Right.
And that's a different story. Like, you might be a great, you know, I might enjoy playing basketball, or you might be a great fisherman. Those are hobbies, and there's a very small percentage of people that may get paid to do that. Now, maybe you start a TikTok doing trick shots, or maybe you start taking the recording of yourself fishing and bass fishing, and it takes off. That's all fine and well, but realistically and statistically speaking, those things are hobby. Unless there's a path to finance, then you have a career, if that makes sense. It's the same sort of thing when you look at, you know, some people go into, you hear people all the time, like, oh, I want to be a video gamer. Like, that's fine. People do that. People make money doing that. People put their video games on TV. People watch people play video games on TV, which I will never understand. Like, literally, you can pick up the controller yourself.
Right.
You know, my parents were always like, you know, you sit that close to the TV, you're going to go blind. You know, you remember that?
Yep.
Growing up. And now I can't imagine what our grandparents would say and stuff like that, seeing how much time we are in front of a screen. But there are people with all different passions. And so if what you would do would succeed, is it something that is then going to make you successful financially? It's going to provide for your family, whatever. And if it's not, and it's just a hobby, that's great, but we got to find something else.
All right. So let's kind of take the two pathways. And because this is one of my biggest objections to, you know, sort of like traditional academics and that pathway. You have path A, where, you know, you develop your interests and then you go get the skill set.
Yep.
Based on your interest. And you have most of the population can't decide, so they just sit at home and play video games and they waste time. So the other pathway is you go get a bunch of specialization, and then you figure out your pathway after you get some specialization. It seems like both of those pathways suck pretty hardcore, right?
Yeah.
But what's the proper way? You know, when we were in school and they handed out, junior year, they wanted us to pick out what we wanted to do.
Yeah.
And they handed out these sheets of paper with all of the amount of money careers, they made, right?
Yeah, the amount of money. Anyways,
right? So we're to Nicole, like, oh, I want to be a physical therapist. Anything that was that six digits, that's what you wanted to be, had nothing to do with what you really wanted to go on. But there's some psychological sciences that we could probably tap into at this point that could make fairer predictions about what you're going to be good at and what you're going to enjoy doing. It's not going to be a hobby that is lucrative. You know, you'd think that there's a little bit more points of data now.
Yeah, well, and there's actually a trend on TikTok right now of people. It's a stitched video where people say, tell me what you went to college for and tell me what you do now. And some of these videos are people are like, well, I went to college for hotel management or whatever, and I'm in sales for Cutco or something. You know what I mean? Like, they diametrically opposed to where they were. And you look at that, and Mr. Wonderful, you love Mr. Wonderful from Shark Tank. He is on TikTok, and he did a video and said, there's only three majors I would encourage people to go to college for. And you should try number one, engineering, number two, engineering, number three, engineering. And he's like, and I'll give you a fourth one.
Engineering.
And obviously he's poking fun at that a little bit, but you know, with that, you know, we don't need a degree in basket weaving. Like, you know what I mean? There's just some stuff out there, and the trades get so neglected. I mean, to go down, you know, this path a little bit, we need good carpenters, electricians, and HVAC people. And
but I don't mind so much if you use sort of the exposure to something to figure out if that's what you want to do, but it doesn't require like so much exposure to it. I mean, you can go to YouTube and say basket weaving, let's watch it be done. I picture myself doing that,
right?
Go buy the materials at Michael's and weave yourself a basket and see where it takes you, right? I just saved you $25,000.
Nice. Exactly. But in fairness to particularly our generation, you know, college was seen as the great hope. Like, you go to college, right, you get your degree, and you are set for life. And like, that was preached to us. It was indoctrinated to us. And a lot of us went to school for things that are now obsolete. A lot of people went and got degrees and got stuff that the industry doesn't exist anymore. And they've had to morph, and they've had to figure things out, or they've had to make less money than they thought, or college costs them way more than they thought. You know, I have a lot of friends that went 6-7 years and aren't doing what they were supposed to do. I've even had this contention, you know, with ministry. Like, you know, it was probably, if I'd have paid out of pocket, it would have cost me probably between 70 and 80 grand for school. I can tell you, as a youth pastor right out of Bible college, one church I made $14,000 a year, and the next church I made less. I made $6,000 a year. So I can tell you that I had to work extra jobs. I was bivocational. That did not match the degree that I had hanging on the wall. And I'm 36 and I still have 30 some thousand dollars worth of student loans. You know, those things, you know, never entered into the picture when I went to school. Oh, well, you have to go to school. And I look at that and I go, well, for ministry, there's a few things that you need, but I would say, and I'll just use my profession. I learned at Bible college how to write papers, how to read really complicated theological texts, and how to be a theologian. I did not learn how to lead people. I did not learn how to pastor. I didn't really learn. I took one class on preaching. You know where I learned all that? On the job. Like, when I had conflict management and someone wanted to rip my head off because of the way I talked to their kid or something. I had a parent cussing me out my office. I learned conflict management real quick. you know, but you're 24, 25, and you're the expert because you got the degree on the wall. And all the degree did was teach me how to open my Bible and, you know, not mess it up.
Right.
But it didn't teach me the 90% of ministry, which is dealing with people, dealing with budgets, casting vision, you know, helping people along in their own calling, coaching, leadership. I mean, all of that. I took one class, Principles of Leadership, and I loved the professor I had for it. The three books were really great, but you're talking, I don't know, I got a grand total of 12 hours on leadership, and literally what I do every day is leadership.
Right.
And, you know, so the way it's taught and what's done, like, you weren't brought into any of that. And so you have a lot of churches now that are raising up these ministry schools and stuff like that. And they're 1 year, let's give you the Bible stuff, and then let's pair you up with somebody that's doing this and let's teach you how to do it.
Right.
We
do this exercise, and it's probably not going to work with you because you're weird too. Deb and I ask ourselves every once in a while, if we got in our time machine, we found the 13-year-old version ourselves, we describe what our life's like right now, and what's the response of the 13-year-old version of yourself? So you do that to yourself, and what's the younger version of yourself's reaction?
And what's the younger version of myself's reaction?
You describe exactly what you're doing right now.
At 13.
Yeah.
So at 14, I got called to ministry. So at 13, I was thinking I was going to be a police officer, a chef, or a history teacher. We had a vocational class.
Hey, I'm not judging. No,
we had a vocational.
You do you, man.
We had a vocational class in school,
right?
And you got the book with all the, and you got to pick three professions, and then you got to spend a week with each one. So I got to go to the vocational school and cut up carrots for a week. That sucked. I was like, I'm not doing that.
You're not doing that, right?
Got to go on like a ride along with police officer and got to go to
shoot
station.
Anybody with
no,
a
but it was
taser?
I got locked in the cell and fingerprinted. That's not
part of being a police. Come on, you want to bust somebody?
Yeah, and. And then I got to hang out with my history teacher, who I happened to really enjoy being with that year. And we got to help, you know, facilitate a lesson and do some of that stuff. And but so at that point, that's probably where I was at. I mean, I was in church, but I wasn't necessarily thinking ministry as a calling. So I'd probably be surprised.
You would?
In that sense. I think I probably would have wanted to meet my wife faster, because I don't think I had met Sam at that point, or we were just meeting. That would have been kind of cool to, I mean, we were young enough. We were 16 and 14 when we started dating. So, but how about you?
Deb's earlier version of herself would laugh hysterically and not believe that that's her. She was a little flower child hippie chick when I met her. So having and being doing what she does now, she would never believe it. Now, she knew that she was going to be a teacher forever, so that wouldn't surprise her. Profession wouldn't surprise her.
Okay.
But what she's exposed to and what she does now, that would be very surprising. Me, no, I wouldn't be a surprise at all. I mean, if you take a look at what I did, I just do it in a different scale now. It's the exact same stuff.
Yeah. And it's interesting when you go back and think like, you know, I can remember, you know, I was going to be Michael Jordan and, you know, you have like those childhood kind of things. And then you hit a certain point and you're like, you know, like Charlotte right now, she wanted to be a ballerina. Then she thought she'd be a librarian cause she liked books. And now she really loves animals. So she wants to be a zoologist and maybe one of those will stick or boomerang. I don't know. But you know, I feel like my progression kind of went that way. And then, you know, for me, I felt very called to use that word. Like I just felt that pull into what I do now. And at 14, it was like, that's what I'm supposed to do. So that, like, I put blinders on and that's what I did. So,
all right.
You should call in. We've been going for 35, 40 minutes.
You can call and you can win $700 and a pair of AirPod Pros. You call the number 330-595-1600. You guess a 3-digit code. If it opens the safe, you win whatever's in the safe. And I have 3 hints, and I'm not going to give any more hints until it gets over 1K, and then you'll get some more. But the first one is that I got the number off of a clock. The second one is partners. And the last one is the digits. 1 is even and 2 are odd. And so if you're keeping score at home or have a spreadsheet, this might help you. Those might not.
Tuesday, the guy who called had a spreadsheet, and he was ready to go.
Yeah. So if you want to win, go ahead and call and put your guess in. Doug will punch it in. So
very cool. So when you have issues, I think, in your life, most of them stem back to we don't know who we are or we're trying to be something that we're not. I often think of... and I've used this in sermons before, the moment in Aladdin where he's trying to be Prince Ali and he's trying to sweep Princess Jasmine off her feet and everything's blowing up in his face and the genie turns into a bee and is buzzing around him and he just keeps swatting the genie away and the genie finally says to him, remember, be yourself. And if he would have just been himself, that didn't sound right.
It's all good. I know what you meant.
if he would have just committed to being him, that's who the princess ends up falling in love with. And a lot of times we have this picture of somebody that we think we want to be or think we should be or that others want us to be. And we spend our whole life trying to be that when we should just be ourselves. How important is authenticity in the identity equation?
So I don't have many regrets, but when I picture myself when I first started in business, 19 years old, and when I would dress up super pretty and go in and try to use words that were way above my, I could just imagine the misuse of words that I had at the time, just trying to sound sophisticated and older than I actually was. And so I wasn't myself. Now I don't care, right? I just go in and I'm 100%. I'm like, man, I really wish I could go back and say, dude, that one thing when you're 19 years old, don't think you have to be older. Go in there like a 19-year-old and you will actually inspire the person. And maybe they want to do business with you because it's not this like super polished, fake as could be, you know, person that you brought into that office.
Yeah. Well, when I first, 8 years ago, when we first came as lead pastors, I can remember I bought a few more button-down shirts. And I came into the office with my button-down shirt and a nice blazer. And I, you know, was trying to come in and be I was 28. I was trying to be a 50-year-old lead pastor. And I can remember trying to have agendas for all my meetings and figure out and be this. And I'm like, that's just not who I am. Nope. And it lasted about 3 months. And I'm like, I'm wearing a hoodie. That's just who I am. I'm going to wear a t-shirt. I'm going to wear a hoodie. And I'm going to be me. And it's not like disrespectful for those people that wear the button downs, like by all means, like if that's your deal, like go ahead and do that. And I dress up for weddings and funerals and that sort of stuff. But
you see how we tried to gravitate towards what we thought we should be doing rather than who we were and what we were doing.
And that happens with so many people. You know, they try and become something their parents want them to be, or their spouse wants them to be, or what they think their industry requires them to be. And in actuality, what the world needs is you. there's two kind of adages that I throw out every so often is all of us are born an original, but too many of us die a copy. We try and become someone else. And a lot of us die at 25. We're just not buried till we're in our 70s. And if we could understand that the world needs you, Joe, this reminds me of a scripture.
I was waiting for it. I was ready for it.
We only did one last show.
Yeah.
But Psalm 139, the psalmist writes that I'm fearfully and wonderfully made, and that his works are wonderful, and that he knew me before any of my days came to pass. And that idea that, like, I have been knit together, I've been put together on purpose, brought to earth for this reason. I mean, that gives you a whole different perspective. But if I go around spending my time on earth not being Doug Reed but trying to be Joe Danier, I'm gonna be not good.
Yeah.
and
miserable, and not accepted, exactly. A phony, a fake, not trusted,
and vice versa. There's a preacher that my wife and I really love, her name's Christine Kane, and for the longest time, do you know who Joyce Meyer is? Joyce Meyer's a real big speaker, okay. Christian speaker, does conferences. I'm going to say this and somebody's going to crucify me, but she's older. Like my mom's a big fan. She's got to be in her 60s or so.
Okay.
Chris Kane's a little bit younger, and Joyce Meyer kind of took her under her wing with certain things and became kind of like a spiritual mom to her. And people would go up to Chris Kane all the time and be like, oh, you're going to be the next Joyce Meyer. You're going to be the next Joyce Meyer. And the one day, Chris Kane, she's a spunky Australian chick, and she goes, I'm not going to be the next Joyce Meyer. I'm going to be the first Chris Kane. Like, in that sense. And I remember her saying that in a sermon. I was like, because, you know, so often you're like, Joe doesn't want to be the next Elon Musk. He wants to be the first Joe Danier.
Yep.
I don't want to be T.D. Jakes or Stephen Furtick or pick your favorite, you know, TV preacher. Like, I want to be who God's made Doug to be. And whatever that looks like, whether people like it or not, whether it's, at Bridge of Hope, whether it's here in the podcast booth, whether it's on TV, wherever that is, I just want to be me, and I want to be me really, really well, because that's all he's ever asked me to be.
All right. So here's that same pathway thing. So you have somebody who doesn't know their identity.
Yeah.
So they're going to sit there and play video games until they figure it out, or they're going to fake an identity and figure out if they want to be that until they are. So again, I don't know which one I'd prefer, if somebody's walking around inauthentic, but at least trying to discover it, right? As long as they know that's what they're doing, they're role playing in their way into discovering who they really are. Because I don't know how you do it. I don't know how you, because I meet a lot of people who apply for positions here, and that's one of the questions that I ask, whether or not, you know, what they can see themselves doing, what they love, what their passions are, and whatever. You know, people say, I'm figuring it out, right?
Yeah.
And so, but I know that, especially in like the millennial generation, they're perpetually figuring it out, and they don't latch on to anything, and they just bob around forward. And it's, again, it's sad.
Yeah. So for me on that end, I try and look for people that I have a chemistry with, and regardless of what their purpose might be, like they might, be completely outside of the sphere. Like, I don't need them to be a pastor, if that makes sense. I don't need them even to go to my church. But if I have a chemistry with somebody, we can help them figure out their purpose along the way. You and I didn't connect because you were a pastor or any of that stuff. We connected because we had chemistry and we had a calling to change the world, and that resonated inside of ourselves. And so it wasn't this, big moment where we're like, boom, we're supposed to be together. Over time, as we hung out, we kind of figured out like, oh, we probably could do a podcast and this could probably work out. And, you know, maybe there's some stuff here business-wise and church-wise that intersect, and maybe we can do this, and maybe I can come alongside and help that. And, you know, God interweaves these things. This is going to sound horrible because I'm so high on the relational side of things. I don't care if we're in the same industry. If I don't like you, it's very hard for me to want to spend extra time,
right?
And go on adventures and try things. Like, I want to do life with people I enjoy being around. I heard a pastor say one time, like, if the church closed tomorrow, I would hang out with my team. Like, because they're my best friends. Like this is fun for us, and right. And we got into relationship, and now we're on this journey. We happen to be building the church together, but if the building closed tomorrow, if the business shut down tomorrow, like, these are my boys, right. and that for me, I can't say has always been true, but I know that as life goes on, it's too short for me to spend a whole chunk of time frustrated with people. And so I look for the chemistry portion. I'm like, man, if I really enjoy being around somebody, let's find something to do together. Like,
right.
Like we can find the purpose. So book, Good to Great by Jim Collins. I don't know if you've ever read it. In there he talks about the who being the most important component of business and who will determine what. He said a lot of people start with the what, and then they try and plug the who in and they end up with a square peg and a round hole. And it just frustrates everybody. But if you get the right who, well, we'll figure that out. The what will come out of those sort of relationships, if that makes sense. Who are some of the people in your orbit that are there? Do you pick people that way? For me, it's like, man, I have to enjoy somebody. And then, man, I really like spending time with them. So, like, let's go change the world.
Yeah, see, I'm annoyed with everyone. And so, like, I have to be, like, pushed in front of people over and over and over again. and the gears kind of, like, the edges that annoy me, they get broken off enough times, and then they don't annoy me anymore, and then I can, you know, coexist with them in spaces.
Joe's best relationships, if everybody heard that, are coexisting
ones. Coexisting, where the things end up breaking off that annoy me about you. Oh, it just happens. Like, but that's how, like, my face has to be pushed into something in order for it to be. So if I'm there, it's there with against all frictions that were there at the beginning.
I would say that's your wiring, though. You're driven by the cause far more than the people. And if the people happen to align with the cause, great, you'll do it. But you're not going to necessarily, or if somebody else has passion and you see that and you can align them with the direction you're going, you're in.
I feel at the same time, like, though, I'm tolerating most people, and I'm thinking, and then I question, like, how many people are tolerating me?
I used to say to my wife when we were dating, we're all weird. It's just what we're weird in.
Right.
Like, some people are, like, not socially acceptable weird, and we're like, okay, that's weird for everybody. But then there's quirky things, and we all have those strange, you know, idiosyncrasies, but that's what makes us us.
That's right.
And those are the fun things in life. Not to quote Robin Williams in, Good Will Hunting. You know, he talks about his wife who passed from cancer and how she would fart in her sleep and wake herself up. And he goes, nobody knew that but me. And he goes, those are the weird little things that make us us, or something along those lines. And those are the powerful things that we all try and hide from each other. But those are, like, the life-changing things that when they come
out. My wife would say I tell on myself every time this thing's on, and there is nothing hidden, honestly.
Yeah. But that's a fact of the world that we live in, right? Where everything's on social media, all of our Instagram, wherever, your pictures, your thoughts. I mean, you post most mornings. I rapid-fire Joe posts when I wake up that, you know, his musings, ramblings, whatever it is. And, you know, but you're putting that out there forever to the world. So don't ever run for office. Okay.
That's what's cool. I'm thinking, like, nobody will know what to use against me because it's already been used up. They'll be digging, like, nope, said it. Nope, he said it. Nope, he said it. And if, as long as I, like, weave my identity around, you know, my overcomings, then, you know, and I always had to be smart enough that even people who were taking shots at me knew that I could probably vaporize them with a space laser or something like that. So they wouldn't.
That's awesome. The person sitting in the audience and they're just like, I'm just trying to survive right now. I get a lot of that in my office at church where people come in. I don't have time to think about what am I built for? What's my purpose? Like, I'm up to my eyeballs in debt. My marriage isn't good. My health's not, like, I'm just stuck. So I don't have time to think, you know, Pastor, that's real nice. You know, you want me to talk about, you know, what I'm here for. Right now, I just would like to make it through the week. How do you help somebody that's in that kind of spot? Are you the type of person, do you assess that situation? Because there's one of two ways, right? Like, somebody would come in and say, all right, I want to help. You know, you got financial pressure. Let me alleviate that. Let me help you in the health side. And then other people are like, you know what? You got to hit rock bottom. And, you know, I'm going to stand right here. I'll be here with you. And when you hit there, I'll help you climb out and we'll figure it out together. But even it, with some of the, you know, people in recovery that we've been dealing with, you know, some of them, you know, you kind of want to help, and then others of them, you're like, you know, I still think they got some more to tumble before they're going to climb themselves out of that. Am I enabling? Like, you ask all those type of questions, but somebody in that spot, they don't care about their identity. They're just trying to figure it out. But I would say when they're in that spot, nothing is more important than their identity.
Yeah.
Because that's the thing that's going to drive you to climb out.
Yeah. So, and you know, honestly, I've seen three different profiles here, and when people are bouncing around, it's almost like someone who says that, you know, they want to lose weight, but then you look at what they're doing and they make good decisions, and then they have equal bad decisions and good, and they just stuck
in
that space.
Stop talking about me, Joe.
Stuck in that space perpetually, right? Yeah. And so like when they, that's terribly frustrating when you know that you can't conquer that, that deal. So usually the skill set that I'll teach is, you got to establish a standard or a status quo, right? So you can cock like what I want this table to look like. And so then I'll go around and straighten this table, but then I take a picture of it and that becomes my status quo. If I want to know where I started from and where at least I don't want to be below that, then I can take that picture out, look to what it's supposed to be, compare what it is. And I don't necessarily need to be shooting the moon. I don't need to, you know, but at least I want to bring it back to the spot where I feel comfortable, where it's not working against me, where it's not a negative.
Yeah. No, that totally makes sense. You know, when folks get in that spot, I know for me, my tendency is to want to jump in and pull them up and be like, let me dust you off and help you. But sometimes I'm doing them a disservice.
Big time.
And I've realized that as life has gone on, like sometimes like they got to crawl around in there until they decide they don't want to be in there anymore. Like if I pull them out, they're just gonna say, why'd you pull me out of there? I liked it in there. You know, some people are like, I like my own mess and I don't know how to do normal up here. You know, so you have to be able to read each situation. But I really think identity is that foundation that when they hit the bottom, they have to be able to build on that. I was saying it to the guys in recovery yesterday during group. I was like, if all you are is somebody who stays sober, you've already lost.
Yep.
I was like, you have been put here for more than staying sober. Now you need to get sober, yes, and you need to be able to, you know, walk through this addiction and be able to not drink or not do drugs like that, because that's going to affect your purpose. But you're so much more than that, and I feel like the mentality of like once an addict, always an addict, like that drives me a little nuts, because there's a whole bunch of stuff in my life that I was that I'm not anymore. And why does that have to be a forever identity when it was just a season? It might have been a long season. Might have been a very shaping season. It might have been a deep season. It might have been 20 years. But at the end of the day, when, yes, you have to get sober, but you're so much more than that. And
but it becomes your default setting. Exactly. And that's, you know, your standard is set by sort of that what people want you to be or what you think you should be rather than what your purpose would be. But, you know, like you said, if you're going through recovery, at least get something that's stable. I don't really care what it is, honestly. Yeah. But once you heal, you can scrap that identity and start building on what you were really designed to do.
Well, and I find that when I feel like I'm being authentic and I have my base, my identity, and I start deviating from that is when my life goes out of rhythm. And the only thing that brings me back is to go, all right, let's center myself back in. This is who I am. This is what I'm built to do. This is what I've been made for. And I go back to that spot and I breathe and I recalibrate my rhythm, because when I'm off trying to do something over here or something out in right field, that's not my identity. It's obvious to everyone around me. It's kind of like, I don't know if you've ever tried to write your signature with your non-dominant hand. Like you might get the job done, but it looks like crap.
Right.
And so to move the pen back into my dominant hand, there's a lot more confidence in that. I've done it thousands of times, and that's the hand that I'm meant to write with. So it's one of those things that I think,
and it's not universal too. Like I've watched you and I being good at different things where I thrive on entropy and the disorder, right? That's where I want to jump into and start organizing things that are in disarray. Mm-hmm. And then I've watched you kind of like, you know, gravitate towards the orderly and to have the predictable and whatever. But like, I'm not afraid to have order, but that's just my best spot is to be doing, especially because there's nobody there usually and I can just do my thing.
Most people are like, oh, I'm staying over
there. Yeah, right.
Joe, when you clean that up, call me.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's true. And that's why you love to start businesses and do the entrepreneur thing. It's part of the reason why you love to jump in and help businesses that are floundering. You see the chaos and you're like, hold on, I can set this back.
Put me in a cubicle and I want to die.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Hallelujah.
That's so good. Well, hey, if you're still with us and still listening, it is 6:58. We've been going for a bit. You can still call in. We're going to go for about another 10 minutes because Fast Freddy's coming up at 7:30 at his new time slot. We are here, and you can call 330-595-1600 and win $700 and AirPod Pros.
You want to try code? I mean, you're co-host. You can give one a shot. I make the rules. I can do whatever I want.
My wife will be very excited if we get this.
Okay.
And it's on a clock, and you said you saw it on a clock, so is it in order on the clock? And partners. Try my birthday. Now you got to think of which number it is.
You didn't know you were allowed to do it. Now you know.
Let me keep a little chit sheet here. That's cool. Is there anything in Joe's world? I know you've been looking to break into a couple of these industries. Is there anything in your world that opportunities that come and you're like, no, not called to do that? What are some things that you've shot down because they didn't align with you?
Like as a principal or like math or?
I mean, you get business opportunities that come in. You've had relationships, I'm sure, that have come in. And some of those, I get people all the time, Pastor, I got a ministry. I want to start. And I'm like, that's great. You should go do that. But that doesn't align with where Bridge of Hope's going. Like, I don't have time, resources, or people to send right. your way. This is what we're doing. You know, but you have your hands in a lot of different pots. And so, you know, but there's got to be somebody that's walked through these doors and you're just like, that person's not in alignment with where I'm going, or that business just great idea. You might actually make a ton of money, but it's just not who I'm built to be.
Yeah. And that's what we said the last time, where if I got to be able to add value to it, I'm just simply not interested. But there are three things that are on the, you know, do not call list, right?
Okay.
Number one is restaurant or bar. And I'm fascinated with these industries.
I love John Taffer and Bar Rescue.
Yeah.
This next season, he was just touting. Are you a fan?
I am. Yeah.
Okay. So he was just touting it on Instagram, and he was on Fox and a couple different things. They're going in and helping bars relaunch after COVID and what they need to do, and you know, all over the place and stuff like that. I'm excited to watch it.
Okay. It is incredibly hard to be unique in that industry.
Yeah.
It's a commodity, you know. People know the drill. It's really hard to stand out, and you know it's the margins are really tight, so it doesn't have a whole lot of room for error or advancement or experimentation. So all the elements I love about business just aren't there. And I've seen some restaurants are able to pull it off, right, to do something completely different.
See, restaurants excite me, and okay. bars excite me because it's a people business. And so, you know, when you talk about, I don't know, inventing stuff, or somebody comes in to sell, I don't know, gun oil or car parts or like that stuff, I'm like, don't care. But like the bar business or like the restaurant, I'm like, like, line me up, people, let's go. Like that to me is,
I could do a cemetery. That's people, right? Totally nail that business.
Yeah. Hey, I hear it's actually pretty lucrative. So no restaurants, no bars.
And then like, politics is one that's on the do not call list right now. I have flirted with it an insane amount of times because here's the go back and forth. Hey, if I was in that position, I can do more. And I'm like, no, if I'm outside of that position, I could do more. And it goes back and forth where I think from the outside, I have less restraints, right?
Yeah.
They don't destroy your character and they don't try to
assassinate everything.
Yeah. Right. And again, you know, they're not, when the crosshairs aren't on your head, you're more freer to go around and make changes. They just don't make the newspapers when you do it behind the scenes.
Yeah. So bars, restaurants, politics, what's the third one?
Well, bars and restaurants were okay. those. Yeah.
So nothing in the food kind of,
But I, you know, I can do a bar or restaurant if I give it to somebody else. If I don't have to personally do it, I think I can do that. Like that's a little asterisk.
Too much people for you.
Yeah. If I have people handle my people, I'm good.
Oh, everyone who's watching right now, stretch out your hand towards Joe. We're
yes,
pray
please,
for him.
Please.
Oh, that's good. But you have to know those things. Like, don't put me in a highly administrative business. Like, I could never do drop shipping or any of that stuff because it's all screens and paper and
it could be as lucrative as hell, and that's right. Not for you.
No, not for me. Sales, real estate, like that sort of stuff. Like, sure. Like, if I'm dealing with people, I'm in. And I love that side of, like, when we were shopping for our house, like, I loved hanging out with our realtor. Like, I wasn't going to the house. I was going to be with my realtor. Right now, working out, I don't like the gym, but I like being there with Johnny. Or when Jed and I were working out, I like going with Jed. Like, I was there to talk and to be with the person. And I got a side benefit of we moved heavy things. But that's always been my wiring. When I was in high school and playing football and guys would come around the weight room of the gym, they're like, oh, Reed, what are you working today? The mouth muscle? Da, 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 da. You know, it was always the running joke. And I was like, yeah, you know, that's what I did. But knowing your wiring is, hey, probably not going to be in those sort of industries. There's nothing wrong with that. I understand my wiring is totally different, and that's okay. I wouldn't want to be stuck on a spreadsheet somewhere or whatever. Like, I just,
or teaching a skydiving school. That's not for you. No. Zero things.
I mean, if I can do it from the ground, somebody else is going to demonstrate,
right?
You know,
you'll teach the book.
Yeah. If I have people to take care of my people for that one.
See what we discovered here. We both have that thing.
That's good. Well, it's like when I first went to Israel, I was literally like, I will take people back here forever. And I'm very passionate about the teaching and the Bible side of things, but I'm just as passionate about the people. And so getting to spend 10 days with 20 to 30 people, you're eating together, you're at the hotel, you're traveling with a tour guide, you're on the bus, you're building these memories and you're laughing, and you leave that space. And yes, you have this beautiful spiritual pilgrimage that's meaningful and deep, but then you have all these relationships with people that are just like, wow, I didn't know them that way. And like, you know, you got to hang out and have conversations that you would have never had otherwise. And so that's what I love about those sort of things. You know, my wife's running joke was that if I wasn't a pastor, I'd be a tour guide. And I would literally, when the last church we were at, we did a building addition, and I would walk people. I was the youth pastor, but if somebody came, I said, oh, have you been inside the building? Let me show you. And I'd walk them around, I'm like, this is going to be this, and this is going to be that, and this is going to be that. Nice. And I'm my lead pastor let me do that. It was awesome. So I had, they gave me a little, hard hat, and I would take them over in the construction zone. And when we were doing our reno, every time you were there, like, hey, come see this. We got the carpet squares, let me show you.
Yeah,
we got
right?
The chair, got the thing. You know, what do you guys think? Do I do this? And, you know, but for me, that stuff is exciting, not because the stuff's exciting, but I get to share it with somebody, and that's what I enjoy.
So do you think in the future you've got an identity that is yet to be discovered? Like, do you think there's a version of you out there that will
I think there's tweaks on what I have. But I don't think I'm going to all of a sudden discover spreadsheets, if that makes sense. I like I was saying earlier, I think 90% of what you're called to do is built into the cake. It's there, and it's just whether it's concealed or revealed. And then you get 10% along the way. You get some nurtured and some put in by relationships or significant moments in your life that shape things. But most of it's already there. It's just a matter of pulling it out. So maybe there's a nugget in there that's going to come out, and I'm going to go, didn't know that was there. I'd like to write a book. I've been working on that for a bit, and I've had three or four that I've started, but none that I've felt passionately enough to put 60,000 words into and finish, maybe some projects that I'd surprise myself with, but I don't know. I think,
you and I go on the road, we get public version of Doug, we get exposure to other markets, and there could be a whole nother dude maybe in there that might just jump out.
It's possible. I don't want to limit it. But I think with each phase, it's just it's almost like a level up, if you will, on the previous phase. So it's not like a brand new as much as it's like a 2.0. Like, you know, you're not scrapping the whole old software and finding this whole brand new thing. It's more like, oh, I picked this up along the way and I didn't realize that was in there because I was exposed to this situation or this scenario. Yeah.
You think about some of those people, even like during the Industrial Revolution, who, you know, they got, even Elon Musk, right?
Yeah,
You know, he starts out writing software, a geeky kid behind a computer screen writing video games and whatever, and has rocket, you know, launching rockets, okay? Go back to the whole engineering thing.
Yeah.
That was the predicate to all of his endeavors.
Yeah. It's fascinating to me, and I do think some of that stuff is progressive, and who knows, maybe there's a chef locked in here or something like that.
You that's never
gonna,
know.
Going to pop out later in life.
I'll have you get the carrots going.
Yeah.
Bad idea.
We were talking. So speaking of chefs, we were talking about Mother's Day, and I said to Sam, I was like, "Well, what do you want to do? Do you, you know, do you want to go to brunch? Do you want to like after church? What do you want to do?" And she was like, "I don't know." I was like, "We got steaks. I can put steaks on the grill. Like, what do you want?" It's Mother's Day pick, and she goes, "Well, I kind of want sushi, but then I got to cook for the kids because the kids are not eating sushi." And I was like, all right, well, let's get sushi. And I said, I'll cook for the kids. And she's like, what are you going to make for the kids? And I'm like, just get me a frozen pizza and I'll throw it in the oven.
Mac
like,
and cheese and pizza. Exactly. That's all.
Kids will be happy. We'll be happy. We'll have sushi. And I always joke when she goes away, you know, for a weekend or for she's going in June to her sister's in Minnesota. And so I'll have the kids for a couple of days. I'm like, listen, we're just going to buy two large sheets of pizza and they're going to be in the fridge. Whenever you guys want it, you just reheat a piece. Sam's like, you can't do that when I go away. And I was like, I won't just do that. We'll just do that for a couple of days.
Well, when you guys come over, remind me that you're sushi lovers, because usually that's a lone endeavor on my part.
We love sushi.
So order pizza for those people and then we'll chow down on some sushi.
We used to, in New Jersey, we had a couple that we hung out with almost every Sunday night, and we would do sushi Sundays and we would order a spread of sushi. And
do you like exotic stuff or do you rolls? Or
Sam's more like California roll, shrimp tempura, that sort of stuff. She's more give me squid, octopus, like whatever I'm in.
Where it's wrapping around your tongue, still alive a little bit.
Yeah. So we every year our leadership team does a pig roast cookout, and I always get one person to taste the brain with me, and it tastes like livery eggs. If you like liver and you like the texture of eggs, that's pretty much what you got when you eat pig brain. And but it's always somebody's like, eh, gross, whatever. And, you know, take a bite and it's a little shock factor or whatever. It's not going to hurt you. But yeah, I'm always the guy that's like, first time I went and had pho, I ate tripe soup. So it's pig intestines and stuff like that. And I don't need to have it again.
Right, right.
But I had it once. And it was, you know, I'd put enough hot sauce on anything, you get it down.
Right. So,
yeah. Well, we are winding down the show here. Fast Freddy's going to be up in about 15, 20 minutes. We appreciate you staying with us a little longer, and hope that some of these questions, some of this discussion maybe spurred some thoughts for you on your identity and who you are, and maybe some of those shifts you can make. And we'll see you back here next week on the Joe and Doug Show.
Thank you for listening to this show on Youngstown Studio. If you like our programming, we invite you to subscribe to our YouTube channel, follow our Facebook page, or subscribe to your favorite podcast platform like iTunes.